Beginning in verse 13, it says, when Yeshua came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he was asking his disciples, who do people say that the Son of Man is? And they said, some say John the Baptist, and others Elijah, but still others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. And he said to them, but who do you say that I am? On Erev Rosh Hashanah, we set out on this series of 8 sermons exploring this question for ourselves, weighing the scriptures, considering their implications. Today on Simchat Torah, the day of the rejoicing of the Torah, we're going to conclude it, even if we have come to no conclusions. And some of you might be anticipating this 8th sermon as if I'm going to give you some straight answer or something, as if I have weighed all the evidence, and after 7 sermons, now we are prepared to clear this mystery up once and for all, to settle this thing once and for all. But that's not what happens on the 8th day. The 8th day is a day of mystery. It's day 8 in the cycle. It's the day in which, it circles back on itself, you have a cycle of 7, and then there's the 8th day. But really, there's only 7 days. So how can you have an 8th day? Well, then the 8th day is the first day, right? So it's like the last day, and it's the first day. It's like the first and the last, I guess. And this is the day we finish reading the Torah. But when we finish reading the Torah, do we conclude the Torah? No, we start it over again. So no conclusions here. With God, all of our endings are beginnings. And I hope that the same will be true for each of you regarding the study of Christology. I hope that our candid and ruthless inquiry into the most sacred of cows, the nature of Messiah, I hope it has not satisfied you. As if you can say, oh, now I know the answer. Now I can explain God. Instead, it is my hope that by shoving the humanity of Messiah forward and making us honestly deal with it and recognize it, and then shoving the divinity of Messiah forward and honestly acknowledging it and dealing with it, I hope that we are better prepared to begin again and to recognize that even the conclusion of the matter, when everything has been heard, is not the conclusion. And we will continue for the rest of our lives to hold the person of Messiah in tension so long as we follow him and are honest with the scriptures, affirming that he is a man, a real human being, and at the same time affirming that he is more, that he is the Son of God, and more than that, and he is the Word made flesh. And the Word is God, through whom all things are made. And because of that, it is possible to speak of Messiah as the very agent of the creation, which we read about in Parashat Bereishit today. Let me just allow a quick refresher course here. If some of you have missed some of the sermons, and this, I know the CDs haven't been available, but let me just go over what we've found so far. Gosh, I'm hungry. On Erev Rosh Hashanah, we began this. We're reading about John on the island of Patmos, and he saw the glorified Yeshua. And we embarked on this journey in those first chapters of Revelation, and we laid down some ground rules. Remember, most importantly, that each sermon should be understood in the context of the rest of the sermons. And just as importantly, that we are hereby speculating about God. Not laying down a creed or making a declaration, a rule of participation or something like that. Rather, we're learning together. We're a community of learners. Exploring together. Not playing theological chess games with each other. But exploring and learning together. And on Rosh Hashanah morning, we learned that Yeshua is a real human being. And must be a real human being who suffered as we suffered, was tempted as we are tempted, which means real humanity, not fake humanity, capable of sin, experiencing pain, contracting ritual uncleanness, even dying. And that the Son of Man means the human being. And the implications of really and honestly dealing with this, really and honestly dealing with his humanity, these implications are dizzying. And on Shabbat Shuva, we learned the history of the early Christian Christology, the background to Trinitarianism and the Nicene Creed, and we learned about other Christological models that various heretics, many like ourselves, have proposed in Christian history. And we determined that the Trinity is a valid way of trying to express the mystery of Messiah's relationship to God, but there are also other ways of understanding it, other ways of explaining it, other ways of approaching it. And it should not be regarded as the baseline. On Yom Kippur, we learned that Messiah is the Son of God. We learned about His atoning sacrifice. We learned about that title, about that name, about that relationship, sonship. We learned that His oneness with the Father is not sameness, that there is distinction between Father and Son, but they are nevertheless inseparable. Distinct, yet inseparable, so that it was impossible for the apostles to talk about God, to even make a blessing or greet someone or offer a prayer of thanks to God without including the Son. And we learned about the Son's sinlessness, born of a woman, born under the law, yet born without a father, sinless for sacrifice, the Son of God. On the Shabbat after Yom Kippur, Shabbat between Yom Kippur and Sukkot, the Sabbath before Sukkot, we explored the Father-to-Son relationship further and learned from the Gospel of John that Yeshua is sent from the Father, that before His birth He was with the Father, shared His glory, that He descended from heaven to be found as a man. And as God's agent on earth, He perfectly represented the Father so that He could say, "He who has seen Me has seen the Father, and I and the Father are one." But we also observed, again, oneness is not sameness. He is not the Father. He is the sent one of the Father. And that in His ascension, He returned to the Father, returning to where He was before, bringing us into the same kind of relationship with the Father that He has. So He told His disciples, "I ascend to My Father and your Father, My God and your God." And Thomas, on seeing the living Messiah, exclaimed, "My Lord, my God," just as Yeshua had told them, "believe in God. Believe also in Me." Then on Shabbat Sukkot, we came to this critical passage. Maybe this is a sermon I've heard from most people that confused them the most. The prologue to the Gospel of John, which describes the Logos, the Word made flesh. And by comparing this text with other ancient texts, the Targums on Genesis, Philo's work, we realized that the Logos, the Word, is the same theological concept as that of Memra, the Aramaic word, a theological buffering for God. The Word, the Memra of God, is a finite projection of Himself which can interact with the finite order. Through the Memra, all things have been created. The Memra is God. It is God in this world. It's God as He appears in this world. And the Memra was made flesh. The Word was made flesh, tabernacling in the body of Yeshua, even as the divine presence tabernacled in the Mishkan in the wilderness. And finally, on Shabbat Kol HaMoed, we learn that before Abraham's time, even since the foundation of the world, Yeshua was, both as the infinite Word, which is God, also in His individuality, His eternal soul. And therefore, we see again Messiah's distinction from, and yet inseparability from, the Almighty. Those are the things we've learned thus far. Have we nailed anything down? I think not. I think He has escaped our grasp, as it says again and again in the Gospel of John. They tried to seize Him, but He escaped their grasp. And I hope you realize after studying this thus far that I have not been trying to answer the question that's burning on everyone's minds. Is Jesus God? Because to pose that question to me is to completely misunderstand the point of Yeshua. He is God represented to us. The glory of the Father. The image of the invisible God. Which is to say, if God were a man, Yeshua is that man. Because in Him, the fullness of God dwells corporally. This is what the Apostle Paul tells us. This is how he describes the Word being made flesh. Here's what he says in Colossians 1:19. You're going to want to be in Colossians. In Colossians 1:19, he says, "For it was the Father's good pleasure for all the fullness to dwell in him." And in chapter 2, verse 9, he says, "For in him all the fullness of deity dwells in bodily form." So this is a key verse. I think here we've come to the center of the issue. The fullness of deity, in some versions it says the fullness of Godhead dwells in bodily form. What does this mean, fullness of Godhead? Every time we say Godhead, because of Christian conditioning, we think Father, Son, Holy Ghost. So the fullness of the Father, Son, Holy Ghost dwells bodily in him. That's not what Paul had in mind. Instead, you have to know some things about Colossae. We've studied Colossae before in the Beit Midrash. What's going on in Colossae? Gnosticism is going on in Colossae. In Colossae, Gnosticism has sprouted up, and there are believers in Colossae who are looking towards angelic visions, dreams that they have received from angels, telling them how to free their souls from their bodies. And there's this dualism. They're saying the world is bad, matter is bad, the physical world is bad. I want to be spiritual. I want my spirit to be released from my body. They're looking to Gnosticism. And Gnosticism believes this. You have to know this about Gnosticism. That Gnosticism believes that, like we were saying regarding the Memra, that God is too much for this world. He's infinite. This world is finite. God, God's good. The world is evil. Or vice versa, depending on which Gnostic strain we're looking at. But so God needs an intermediary to enter this world. If God's going to interact with this world, he needs an intermediary. And there's different ways that this is expressed in different forms of Gnosticism. But you see, this sounds very much like what we were learning at the beginning of the Gospel of John. And it is very much the same idea. So what's the problem with Gnosticism? If it's just the prologue to the Gospel of John, what's the problem with it? Well, it's not just the prologue to the Gospel of John. Rather, John is answering Gnosticism, and Paul is answering Gnosticism here. Because Gnosticism was, in a sense, it was polytheism. Gnosticism was a way of reconciling monotheism with polytheism. Because Gnosticism would say, yes, there's one God, he's the infinite God, he's the God above all, he's the prime cause, but he is not the creator God. Instead, to create, he needed to have an intermediary form. And this intermediary form is called demiurge. The demiurge, this is what people believed. The demiurge is a lower form of God, represented as angels. The angelic hierarchy. The angelic beings. The angelic court. You recognize all of these themes from Scripture. You find these things in Scripture, of course. But this is, so the Gnostic could not reach to the infinite God. He knew that. But somehow he had to get out of this wicked corporeal existence. And so he sought out secret knowledge which would be transmitted to him from this demiurge, that he might reach that level of the angelic spheres of the demiurge. And this level of the angelic beings, which are the gods of the ancient world, this level of angelic beings represent different attributes of God and are called pleroma. How are we saying it? Pleroma? Pleroma. I was asking them about the Greek last night. Pleroma. And it is also the same implication in the word for Godhead that we find here. So in Colossae, you have this whole convoluted belief system going on. Pleroma, it's a Greek word for fullness. When Paul says, "For in him all the fullness of deity dwells in bodily form," the fullness of Godhead, he says the pleroma. Pleroma is a Greek word for it's like it's used to speak of a ship when it has its full manifest. All the passengers are on board, you got a pleroma. But like I said, it's also the term used by the Gnostics to speak of the intermediary beings between God and the physical world, a technical term used in Paul's day for the demiurge, the intermediary between God and the physical world, used in much the same way that the writers of the Targum use the term memra, but different because it allows for an angelology, an angelic hierarchy by which God can be known. Now, Paul, was Paul a Gnostic? Was Paul a Gnostic using this terminology? No. Instead, as he writes to the Colossians, he's refuting these Gnostic ideas. Those who believe in these visions of angels, remember what he says in Colossians 2:18? He says, you know, don't buy it. Don't even listen to these people who believe they have seen these visions of angels, who delight in self-abasement and the worship of angels, taking their stand on visions they have seen, and their minds inflated without cause, their fleshly minds inflated without cause. Paul's speaking, he's bringing correction to this situation. This Gnostic belief was that through Gnosis, that's knowledge, secret knowledge, a person could reach that pleroma, this angelic hierarchy. Like if you could just get the right creed, if you could just get the right formula, if you could get the right belief down, you'd be set free from your body. Paul calls these the hollow, empty doctrines and commandments of men in Colossians. He says in verse 8, he says, see to it. Chapter 2, verse 8, he says, see to it that no one takes you captive through philosophy and empty deception, according to the tradition of men, according to the elementary principles of the world, rather than according to Messiah. What are the elementary principles of the world? It's this pleroma. It's the zodiac. It's the angels. The intermediary beings. Because you can't go straight to God. Since God cannot interact directly with creation, he has all these agents, these elementary principles. Paul refutes it all. And in verse 9 he says, for in Messiah all the pleroma of deity dwells in bodily form, corporeally. And in him you have been made pleru, you have been made full. So he says, forget it. All that crazy stuff they've been teaching you. All that crazy stuff about intermediary beings and angels and secret knowledge. Forget all that. Because you know what? You want to know where the fullness of God is? The fullness of God, the pleroma, God in this world, the demiurge of God, God in this world, it dwells in Messiah. And through Messiah, you too are made full. You too have been made complete. And so the fullness of God dwells in you. Because you have Messiah. So when Paul says in him, all the fullness of deity dwells in bodily form, he's saying there is no pleroma. There is no angelic hierarchy that you should be seeking knowledge to attain for your salvation. There is no secret knowledge. There's no secret knowledge. Messiah is it. The pleroma dwells in him. It inhabits him. He is the Word made flesh. He is, as it were, God on earth. There is no other route. There is no other pleroma. There is no secret knowledge. According to the Gnostics, it was through the pleroma that the demiurge, that God, as the demiurge, created the world. This is not too far from this concept of logos that John was teaching us, of course. But John is doing the same thing that Paul is doing. He's going into a Gnostic situation, co-opting the language and turning it against them. He's borrowing the terminology of a corrupt teaching system and turning it back on them. We need to understand the context here. verse 13, he says, For God rescued us. That's the he. For God rescued us from the domain of darkness and transferred us into the kingdom of his beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created. By him, in him. In Greek, whatever. In him all things were created. By him all things were created. But listen to what Paul's saying. He's taking this pleroma concept that God can't create. He has to create through the pleroma. He's taking this pleroma concept and he's taking it over. For by him all things were created, both in the heavens and the earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. Did you hear what he's... Thrones, dominions, rulers, authorities, things visible and invisible. That's what the Gnostics in Colossae were seeking after. These are the angelic hierarchies they're looking toward. This is the Pleroma. This is the New Age movement in the first century. And he says, no, all things have been created through him and for him. Here where it says all things have been created through him, it could also be read, all things have been created on account of him. The Greek says that. All things have been created on account of him. In the Talmud, it says, Rav said the world was created for David's sake, on account of David. Shmuel said the world was created for Moses' sake, on account of Moses. Rabbi Yochanan said the world was created for the sake of Messiah, on account of Mashiach. All things have been created on account of him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. Wow. Verse 17, what do you do with that? He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. Super mystical. Quantum physical. How could you say this of a human being? How could you say this even of Adam? How could you say this of someone? Before all things, and in him all things hold together. Obviously not true about a human being. These are statements about the pleroma of God, the fullness of deity that dwells in him in bodily form. And so it is true. So it's obviously true. Verse 18, he is also the head of the body, the church, the assembly. And he is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that he himself will come to have first place in everything. For it was the Father's good pleasure for all the fullness, there it is again, all the pleroma to dwell in him, and through him to reconcile all things to himself, having made peace through the blood of his cross. Through him, I say, whether things on earth, physical matter, this world, or things in heaven, spiritual stuff, which the Gnostics are worried about. They're worried about this separation between matter and spiritual. They're worried about the dualism of the world. That's what they're trying to escape, things on earth, to get to things in heaven. But Paul says, no, he's reconciled these things. There's no dualism in Messiah. He reconciles these things, brings them together, things on earth, things in heaven. They are reconciled in him. So what's the bottom line here? What does the Bible say about Yeshua? After all these sermons, what does the Bible teach about this man? He might put the question to you this way. Who do you say that I am? From me and my house, as Joshua says, he is the Son of Man. He is the Son of Adam, the human being. He is the Son of David, the son of Miriam, the man from Nazareth, a real, normal, physical human being with a normal body. He is the one sent from God, the one who has come down from heaven, sent by the Father, who ascended back to where he was before. Before Abraham, he was. His goings out are from ancient times, from of old. He is the firstborn over creation, the singular Son, the Yahid, the Son of God, in whom the fullness of deity dwells corporally. He is the Word made flesh. He is the risen one, seated at the right hand of the Father, under whose feet every enemy will be subjected. And according to the Epistle of Hebrews, it says in Hebrews 1:2, in these last days God has spoken to us in His Son, whom He appointed heir of all things, and for the sake of whom, or through whom, either way, the Greek goes both ways, He also made the world. And Yeshua is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of His nature. It doesn't get higher than that. He is the radiance of God's glory, the exact representation of His nature, and upholds all things by the word of His power. Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." And Yeshua said to him, "Blessed are you, Shimon bar Yonah, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." 6 days later, Yeshua took him, Peter, James, John, his brother, and led them up on a high mountain by themselves, and he was transfigured before them. And his face shone like the sun, and his garments became white as light. And behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them, talking with him. And Peter said to Yeshua, "Lord, it's good for us to be here. If you wish, I will make 3 tabernacles here, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah." And while he was still speaking, a bright cloud overshadowed them. And behold, a voice out of the cloud said, "This is my beloved Son." Case closed. "With him, with whom I am well pleased, listen to him." When the disciples heard this, they fell face down to the ground and were terrified. And John said, "When I saw him, I fell at his feet like a dead man. And he placed his right hand on me, saying, 'Do not be afraid. I am the first and the last, the living one. And I was dead, and behold, I am alive forevermore, and I have the keys of death and Hades.' And Yeshua came and touched them and said, 'Get up, do not be afraid.' And lifting up their eyes, they saw no one except Yeshua." Chag Sameach.